The Bookhouse is an independent bookstore with two locations in New Jersey, Millburn and Long Branch. Are you the guy who says they like to support indie bookstores? Good. Then be that guy. Come shop at The Bookhouse. Books, puzzles, games, coffee, cards, live author events, comedy nights, and most important, a real sense of community where actual human beings engage with one another. The Bookhouse in downtown Millburn and at Pier Village in Long Branch. That's The Bookhouse. Independent, local, quaint as fuck. Follow us on Instagram and come visit our stores.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Book and Film Globe podcast. I am your host, Neil Pollack, the greatest living American writer and the editor-in-chief of Book and Film Globe. Happy Thanksgiving to all of you. We have a delightful weekend of holiday movies ahead of us. If you haven't been to the theater yet, run, don't walk to go see Wicked and or Gladiator 2, both of which are big hits and both of which are playing now, and both are, I don't know, a lot of fun, really, let's face it. It's fun to go to the movies this weekend, and it's fun to talk about them with Stephen Garrett, and he will be here to talk to me about both of those movies in a bit. I'm also going to talk to Bobby Hilliard about a movie that's not in theaters anymore, but was a huge success this year. I've been wanting to talk about the Terrifier franchise for a while. The Terrifier 3 ran this year and featured the evil Art the Clown in a Santa getup, so I guess it's somewhat seasonally appropriate, but it's worth talking about why these movies are so successful. And it's pretty obvious why Wicked and Gladiator 2 are so successful. They're just big, fun Hollywood genre picks, and there's always an audience for that kind of thing. And Steven will be here immediately to talk about Wicked after this musical, double musical interlude.
You're the one the Wizard of Oz has been waiting for.
You can't pull me down.
The sky's the limit.
You can do this. You can do anything. I know.
Before I saw Wicked last night, I was a heterosexual man. And now that I have viewed three and five halves hours of whatever, how long that movie was, I don't know if I've gone gay, but I have certainly become like a 12-year-old theater kid again.
There you go. Okay.
Yeah.
You got bedazzled.
Yeah, I got, I've got that screech of whatever that thing is, Learning to Fly. What's that song
sure,
at the
Defying
end?
Sure, Defying Gravity.
Defying Gravity. Yeah, that is sort of just playing over and over in my head again and again. And I sort of am humming Popular a little bit to myself. So Wicked is here finally. This is not some underdog film. This is the definition, the opposite of an underdog film, really. But it is first part of a musical adaptation of the hit Broadway show, and it's in theaters now. And Stephen, you saw Wicked. You loved Wicked. You were a big fan.
Well, I thought it, you know, look, I try to meet a movie where it wants to be and where it intends to
right.
be. And I think it did a very good job preserving that theater kid excitement and enthusiasm and fidelity.
Yeah.
I mean, look, was I agnostic? I was pretty agnostic. I mean, I saw Wicked 20 years ago and then never thought about it again. And this movie came out and, you know, I said, oh yeah, I guess I'll go see this dutifully, but I wasn't enthusiastic. So I have to say it did win me over eventually, although it did kind of wear me down eventually too. Because
it's a lot.
It's a lot. But it's very good at what it tries to do. You know.
It's extremely successful sort of pop franchise, essentially, is what it, you know, it establishes its world. It does not really let up, and I think it gives the theater kids what they want. Very lush.
Oh my God, seriously. I mean, you're seeing all that money on the screen. I mean, both movies report, I think the Wall Street Journal said it was $320 million. The Variety and the Trades have been calling it $300 million for both movies. So I guess bifurcated, this was $150 million. But you see the money up on the screen and you see a lot of care and attention and love and detail go into this movie. You said, you know, it's not an underdog, but in a way it kind of was an underdog in the sense that it took a while for them to crack that nut of how to adapt it for screen.
Yeah.
And a like more of a money grab would have been maybe to do it sooner, maybe do it with somebody who really doesn't care about musicals and shove everything into one movie instead of two. I mean, this is faithful to a fault maybe and beloved to a fault because it is very long.
Very long. Well, you know, yeah, the first half is 2.5 hours. And, you know, this is, I'm guessing the musical itself couldn't have been longer than 3 hours. You know, I mean, I don't think people are allowed. Yeah. I don't think you're allowed to. I mean, it wasn't a 7.5 hour play. So, they obviously there's some padding maybe some overhead swooping shots that weren't possible.
Yeah.
But let's talk about the sort of specifics of the movie. Like, I found myself very, I have to admit, kind of captivated by Ariana Grande as Glinda.
That's funny. I was quite captivated with Cynthia Erivo as Elphaba. So I guess we know what team we're on, buddy. Team Glinda.
Yeah, she just struck me as like a theater kid, like a lifelong theater kid.
Yeah.
Who was really just very happy to be playing this, her dream role.
Yeah,
she exactly. was like the kid at camp who gets the part that they really want and then just goes for it with all their gusto. There's no question about it that she delivered that. I mean, yeah, Cynthia Erivo is obviously like, sort of moment for moment a better actor than Ariana Grande, who's not really an actor. This is the first thing she's been in that I can remember that wasn't a music video.
Right.
But I find the character of Elphaba to be kind of boring. And self-righteous.
Well, yeah, I mean, she's very wounded, right, for the whole thing. And the idea of somebody who happens to be green-skinned to be considered an outcast or a freak in this literal land of weirdos. I mean, let's face it, who isn't dressed strange or has a weird hairdo or an odd hat? And they're pointing at her because she actually has a sort of a couture, like beautiful, like black on black kind of dressing and this kind of dope hat. I mean, she looks great.
And yeah, it's obviously extremely good looking. So it's like, well, what are we doing here?
Yeah, what are we afraid of
this,
here?
This is literally a land of where there are, you know, talking animals.
I know. And they're like, watch out for the green lady. God forbid.
Not the bear who's bottle feeding you. Or
yeah, not the bear nanny.
Or the leopard that's teaching you mathematics. You know, it's like, yeah, they're fine. Yeah, so, yeah, then I was, you know, at certain points I was like watching a movie. I'm like, oh yeah, this is actually about Oz. That makes sense. It's like a prequel to The Wizard of Oz.
Well, it's interesting. It's a prequel until it becomes almost like parallel narratives because, apparently, I guess Dorothy shows up at a certain point and
I'm sure she's a real bitch.
Yeah, I know. the what do they call her? The female child who melted the witch.
Right. I'm sure she's not the Judy Garland Dorothy we all remember. I'm just guessing, Stephen.
Well, you know, that movie really put a lot of things in our heads. Like, for example, Munchkins being super small, where in the fact, I think in the book, they're just Munchkins just happen to be the name of people who live in Munchkin Land and who might be a little bit shorter.
Who might be like 5'4".
5'4", yeah. And then, of course, like, you know, MGM ran with it and made them all like super tiny people, so much so that the word Munchkin is now synonymous with super tiny people and super tiny things.
And little donuts.
And little donuts, let's not forget. but, you know, ruby slippers, they're not really ruby. In the book, they're, you know, crystal or what have you.
Right.
And so, there's some interesting things that are actually, I feel like, reclamations of what the book actually originally intended and what we've just gotten used to seeing in our heads. Like Dorothy is actually a 16-year-old girl instead of a 12-year-old girl, you know?
Right. She's more, she's less of a Lolita and more of a, she's a temptress.
Dorothy's a temptress.
A sexy evil.
We'll
see. We'll see. I don't know. All right. Well, this is a musical, and man, does it deliver a lot of singing and dancing.
A lot of razzle dazzle. A lot of like, if a song can't be sung in 5 bars, let's sing it in 10 bars. Like everything is supersized. It seemed to me.
Yeah. Huge dance numbers.
I will say that the brief attempts of Michelle Yeoh and Jeff Goldblum to sing and dance, they kept them brief for a reason.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Those are not musical theater performers. I expected from your review that that John Travolta was going to show up at some point.
Oh, sorry. The wickedly talented
You hinted at that.
No, I hinted at the other big cameos in the movie.
Well, yeah, those I figured. Those, yeah. I guessed. Those were delightful. But, you know, that's the one thing I would say is that, you know, I mean, obviously Michelle Yeoh and Jeff Goldblum are great screen actors, legendary screen actors, and they certainly they're not wooden in this film, but I would say that, like, maybe you might want to have considered casting singing and dancing people in those parts.
Ooh, interesting.
You know, because this is a musical after all.
You could have also maybe thought of developing their characters a little bit more. I mean, I felt like Madame Morrible was like, what? You're just, you know, who are you? And you're not very interesting, or I don't know.
I know. I felt like Jeff Goldblum plays the wizard, and, you know, he's such a well-known archetype that, like,
he brings a lot to it.
He brings a lot to it, and he shows up late in the first half. Of a 5-hour movie, so I'm assuming we're gonna see more of him. I'm guessing he doesn't just fade into the background of the second half. I hope they don't.
And that's the fault, right?
That's the fault.
That's the fault of breaking a movie in half, because you get these characters like Nessa Rose, who is
the sister,
paraplegic sister, and you have no idea what her role is. She's not much of a sister to, you know. Somebody joked to me that, like, oh yeah, like Elphaba and Galinda develop a kind of a sisterly relationship, and you're just like, but, you know, Elphaba does have a sister. She just seems to ignore her or use her in this self-righteous way to be like, I protect the rights of the handicapped, and you're just like, why don't you hang out with your sister?
Yeah, the only reason she actually even goes to that school is to protect her sister, and then she just completely blows her off.
Totally blows her off. So maybe there's more of that. I've read, of course, that there is more to that in Act Two, and there's more substantial.
Well, but that's part of the problem too, is that we spend, you know, an hour and a half kind of hanging around this kind of shitty knockoff of Hogwarts.
I kept expecting people to do magic. Nobody did any magic. They all just, like,
no, there's no magic. Like, she's the only, you know, the only person who has any magic is the witch. So, yeah, so but it's like you keep expecting it, and instead it's just kind of like Saved by the Bell with a green character.
It's pretty much that, yeah. And then, like,
talking animals.
And then magic and sorcery is like an AP course just for, like, select study students.
Yeah, it's an independent study
that she does.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and it's not actually a magic school. They're actually just there to, like, take classes and to, like, go to nightclubs and shit. So there's a lot of lingering on that. And then the movie, to me, like, it really picks up steam at the back third when they finally go to the Emerald City and the plot actually begins to take place.
Right. And then it really actually does become interesting in terms of, you know, good, ideas of evil, ideas of being manipulated, or, you know, getting the thing you want, but realizing it's the last thing you need, and all that kind of stuff.
All those big themes that, like, but at the end of the day, all that really matters is that the theater kids are gasping and singing along and just loving it. They're loving it, Stephen. They love it.
They're loving it.
They love it. They're trembling. They can't wait. They cannot wait to post their screenshots.
Hey, man, God bless. God bless these kids. You know, they waited till they knew they could do it the right, and, you know, Universal, like, said, all right, we will commit to your crazy, you know, idea of two movies. Maybe we can milk it for more money that way. And I mean, it's a bit of a gamble. You know, it could have been a huge belly flop, because, you know, the highest grossing opening of a musical, I think, was like $30 million or something. Musicals are not really, they kind of top out.
They're back, baby. Musicals are back.
I guess they're back.
They're back. I want them to make one out of the Book of Mormon. That's my top choice.
That not Avenue Q? That could be kind of funny.
Yeah, Avenue Q, maybe, but definitely the Book of Mormon. That would be, people give Parker and Stone the screen. Let's see what they do with it. That's what I want. That's the musical for me. Like, I'm more of a cynical, you know, although the movie they made of the producer's musical was bad, But that's the the producers, the Book of Mormon, like the Drowsy Chaperone, like these sort of ironic, funny musicals. That's really what I like. The Wicked is, it's just too sincere for me. You know, I mean,
it's pretty earnest. Yeah.
There's some bangers. There's some bangers in it for sure. But I mean. Am I going to hold this dear to my heart? I'm on my deathbed. Am I going to be whispering the lyrics to Defying Gravity? I hope not.
Not you, but someone else. Someone else definitely
will. Oh, someone will be. Yeah. Someone will be for sure, and this is the movie for them. All right, Stephen, well, you'll be back in a little bit to talk about, the most important movie of the year, Gladiator 2. and I will say, and we're going to get into this more, but you know, there are monkeys in this movie, in Wicked, and there are monkeys in Gladiator 2, but I find the monkeys in Gladiator 2 to be superior because one of them wears a diaper.
Well, you know, none of them are defying gravity because they don't have wings. But in this movie, we find out why they have wings.
They are to some extent, though, because they're wearing a diaper. All right, Stephen, I'll talk to you soon.
All right, talk to you then.
This October, Christmas comes early, and there's a man out there whose only gift is a nightmare. Terrifier, Part 3. No one under 17 admitted.
Regular listeners know that we talk a lot about horror movies. It's I would say the absolute king of all movie genres right now. I mean, individual movies may not make as much as certain blockbusters, but as a genre, it is definitely it is the top of the pyramid. I personally don't watch a lot of horror movies. I'm pretty squeamish. I'm easily scared, but I like to talk to people who do watch a lot of horror movies, and we cover it all the time. Our latest franchise that we wrote about on Book and Film Globe is Terrifier, which the latest edition of Terrifier, like Terrifier 3, I think made like $85 million this year. And it's a Christmas movie in addition to that. So we wrote about it. I got Bobby Hilliard here on the line to talk to me about the Terrifier movies. Hello, Bobby.
Hey.
So, all right. Tell me a little bit about Terrifier and Art the Clown. What is this? What is this franchise?
Basically, it is somehow mainstream, absolute fucking gore fest. Like, uh-huh. I struggle with how that movie has made so much money, but I get it because there hasn't been a slasher icon since the 80s. Like, I mean, you could count Scream if you want, but I don't count Ghostface in the canon with Michael Myers and Jason Voorhees and Freddy Krueger and all that.
Yeah.
Like, he's the first legitimized horror guy that like has really broken through to the mainstream. And it's honestly kind of like, I get the optics of him with the black and white covered in blood and all that. And he doesn't talk. So it's an easily marketable and easily approachable killer. But when I say that he absolutely is an abhorrent character of like maximum violence, I am in no way, shape, or form overplaying how gory those movies are. Like, they cross a line that is, if you read my piece, it says a lot about us as a society that these movies are as popular as they are outside of like a hardcore horror community.
Do these movies have stories, or is it just one disgusting kill after another?
It's basically one disgusting kill after another, because it's like the plots are so shitty, it's kind of unbelievable how shitty the plots are. The first movie, it's just a clown in a fucking used warehouse. Like, these girls wind up needing to go to the bathroom. Like, I'm sorry if I'm ruining this for anybody, but you're not getting any plot out of these movies. They wind up in this warehouse to go to the bathroom. A guy lets them in. Or is that, I think that's the first movie. It's like they're so indistinguishable about the plots that you're just like, yeah, whatever. And this warehouse becomes like this chamber of five different kinds of places. And you're like, you just killed people in a pizza place like two blocks away. How do you not see cops? How are there not cops anywhere? How are there not cops hearing people scream? It's a whole thing of just like absurdity. And it's just gnarly, gnarly, gnarly kills one after another. And then by the time you get to the second movie, they start putting in like dreamscapes and some magical realism. And you're like, okay, we get it. This guy can't be killed because you're keeping the franchise going. And the original slasher movies have instituted that that's okay to the genre. But ultimately, they have no plot. It's just the absolute most fucked up way to kill somebody. They go for it. And like, if you, and you said you haven't seen them, and whatever you think, if you in your youth or whatever of seeing like Freddy Krueger stick his fingers through somebody's stomach and make a quip about it, that is absolutely child's play compared to the way that Art the Clown kills people.
Right. Well, and the Freddy Krueger movies had story, and they had legitimate, you know, scary set pieces, right? I mean, there those scared the hell out of me when I was a teenager, which is when I saw them, but they still were movies, you know, with sort of beginnings, middles, and ends. So I don't know. This is just very strange to me. It just feels like, it sounds to me almost like a fictionalized version of Faces of Death or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, it's legitimately the lack of structure and plot is like this guy tortures people and kill, like, I don't even say tortures, really. He just absolutely like in one of the movies, I think it's the second one, he cuts a woman's head off. And like, not like, it's not that like Hitchcockian, oh, you don't see it. No, you see him cut someone's head off, rip the skin open, and use her head as a candy bowl. Not anything left to the imagination. It is full blown shown. He cuts a guy's dick off. One person gets, in the third movie, he rams a tube down someone strapped to a chair's mouth, like a PVC tube, a clear one, rams it through their mouth and then puts rats through the tube. Like, I think he puts a flamethrower so they race down into the body and then they slit the throat and the rats come out. That's the kind of shit that, like, those movies are.
Did you watch this at home or did you see it in a theater?
We saw the first two at home because they're on Amazon Prime, and then the last one in the theater.
And the theater was, there were people in it. There were people.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, was it full? Would you see it sort of at the beginning of the run or at the?
No, we saw it a couple of days after Halloween.
And I mean, how do people respond to this? Are people enjoying this?
There wasn't any like gasps or anything, but you could hear some, ugh. I can't remember what I got grossed out, because generally, like, I'm a hard sell when it comes to horror movies, because I'm only scared of plane crashes and cancer. Like, horror movies, haunted houses, none of it works on me. I can appreciate the practical effects, and I can't remember what it was. I think it was the idea of, like, somebody getting the palms of their hands cut. That bothered me, because right. I was like, ugh. But, and my girlfriend was like squirming the whole time, but I didn't hear anybody like barfing or passing out, which has been reported.
So what you mentioned this, or you talked about this, like what is the sort of underlying societal appeal of the Terrorizer movies? Because this kind of stuff doesn't get made and doesn't become, it gets made. It always gets made, but it doesn't become popular unless there's a reason.
I think it's a mixture of three things. One, it's one of those like classic, don't go see this because it's really going to fuck you up, like Faces of Death was in the 70s and 80s. Like, oh, beware. It's like they got them on that. Sure. I get that there is like the naughty kid with the cookie jar that you really want to like experience. There's always going to be something like that. That's infamous rather than famous. Two, again, Art as a character works on paper. He's a scary looking clown covered in blood. On paper, the image of him just works. Like, people can kind of get by with that. Like I said, it's that same kind of...
He's iconic.
Yeah, he's an iconic looking character, so that's too identifiable. But yeah. The biggest problem with, for me, is the desensitization of violence that like we have ultimately come to. I would probably blame social media and the social climate that we live within.
Yeah.
But like, I fundamentally think there is an issue. Like, I know a ton of people in the horror community, a ton. I'm not in the horror community, but I have a lot of writer friends who are horror writers and fans. And those people are always going to see horror movies. It's whatever. They're going to be the ones to go see, like, I Spit on Your Grave and all those fucked up movies, you know, from Human Centipede and all that kind of stuff. But ultimately, when something breaks into the mainstream to the tune of almost $100 million, what's kind of the problem is like these movies are so gory and so fucked up. It's like, yeah, I get that you want to see it just for like the, oh, I dare you. But to make three of them says something about like our cultural like insensitivity to like heinous things. And I think that's a problem. Do you find enjoyment out of watching somebody like get their arm hacked off in a room from floor to ceiling, be covered in somebody's blood because somebody just murdered a woman with like a dental scalpel? There's just something inherently comfortable about it that like I don't jive with. Like I come from like a world of DIY underground, whatever. So for me to go see it and my girlfriend, we're the usual suspects, but like everyone else's tolerance to it, to that tune of money, I think is part of a larger social narrative of what the fuck is going on here. Because curiosity is one thing, but the level of curiosity should be like a dog whistle to like a severe cultural undertone.
All right. Well, that is, you've been warned here on the podcast about Terrifiers 1, 2, and 3. Don't become desensitized to people's palms getting cut off with a rat, what, dental scalpel or a rat in a tube, or it all sounds fucking horrible to me. I'm never going anywhere near these movies.
Yeah, I mean, like, let me preface it this way. There's a moment in one of the three where like a chick becomes like an avatar to him, and she wakes up out of like a pool of her own death in a tub, and so she becomes like this avatar of whatever, how art is unkillable. She does too. She like grabs a huge piece of glass from smashing her face into a mirror, like a murder-sized piece of shard of glass, and then like stands and stares at him and like masturbates with the piece of glass. And you watch it and you're like, this is fucking insane.
Well, it sounds great, Bobby.
Yeah, it's real wholesome shit.
Thanks for sharing. We'll talk to you soon. Happy Thanksgiving.
Yeah, I'll be using my piece of glass to carve the turkey.
I have a destiny.
Power.
I will control an empire.
Who are you?
I own you now. You will be my instrument.
I will never be your instrument.
This will be my path to the throne.
Deny me and you will die.
A sequel that no one thought would ever happen has happened and is in theaters now. I'm talking about Gladiator 2. Stephen Garrett reviewed it for us, and he's back again on the show today to talk about... Hello. Hello again, Stephen. Stevenus, Sevenus, whatever.
Reviewerus.
Whatever.
Maximus.
Reviewerus. Yeah, you were. You didn't think you were going to ever have to review a movie again. You were just happily living in Africa with your hot wife, and then you got called into duty. Yeah, so here you go, Gladiator 2. I'll say this. I'm going to start with this. There were more animals in this movie than in any movie since Madagascar.
Yeah, yeah.
So many animals. There's a rhino. There were sharks in the Colosseum. There were baboons. There's a baboon attack.
Rabid baboon attack. Like hairless rabid baboon. What do they shave those baboons? What do they do? They put
nails. Yeah, shaved baboons. Good yeah, the baboons went to the Roman barber, and then of course one of the Roman emperors in the movie has a pet monkey who wears a diaper. You know, the only person in the movie, as far as I could tell, who wears a diaper, although, you know, you don't see Paul Mescal go to the bathroom in the movie. So maybe he's also wearing a diaper, but, I don't know. So I was surprised at the amount of animal plus, you know, horses, and there was a tiger at one point. There's lots of animals in this movie, but there's also people. And this movie is essentially the story of the son of Maximus, who is Russell Crowe's character in the first movie, who eventually finds his way back to Rome and, you know, fights the power that bees in Rome, and just fights. There's a lot of fighting.
I took a super fan, a Gladiator super fan, with me to the press screening, and he was very excited. And I was agnostic. I was like, oh yeah, I haven't seen Gladiator since it came out. And he was like, what? He was like, I watch it every time it is on cable, every time it's put in front of me. I'm like,
yeah, I've seen it every year since it came out.
Pretty all much. Right. So maybe you could speak more to that point. I went back and saw it again and I was like, oh, this actually is a pretty good film. But it's also still like a Gladiator movie, and it's kind of ridiculous in its own way. And I was never a huge fan. And I came out of this being like, yeah, this was just that again. And it was well done for what it is, but it's not trying to be anything more than that. I realized definitely the first one had a bit more integrity and a bit more, you know, intrigue that was actually pretty intriguing. This time around, it just seemed like nonsense.
Yeah, this movie is absolute nonsense. The first Gladiator is just a classic, just the way it's paced, the way it's written. Russell Crowe's performance is freaking iconic. Joaquin Phoenix's villain is iconic. This time, you have Paul Mescal, who does not, as far as I'm concerned, fill Russell Crowe's loincloth. He's just kind of grumpy through the whole movie. He doesn't have
a bit grumpy. He's a better actor than what we see on this, but he's not asked to do much aside from just be, you know, kind of vengeful and full of rage.
Right. Well, Russell Crowe is a great actor too, but he filled the shoes of Maximus. You believe that, you know, whereas Paul Mescal was like, felt like he was like some kind of barista plucked out of a coffee house in Hollywood and placed in a loincloth on armor and told to fight baboons. That's the problem is that, you know, you have to watch him sort of do his two emotions a lot.
But the movie's not requiring him to do more emotions than that anyway, you know? He's just really angry. He's the angry young lad, right?
I understand that, but whether or not a movie requires a performance to be good, there's no humor, you know, there's no glint. You know, with Russell Crowe, like, there's always like this little glint of madness, right? And with Paul Mescal, you don't have that. But I would say this movie is still quite redeemable for a couple of reasons. One, you have Denzel Washington.
It's fantastic.
As the villain. And what he's going to, this movie's not going to win any awards other than perhaps for Denzel Washington, who is just chews up the screen and he's in it a lot. You know, they lean into the fact that they got Denzel Washington. Although I will say, like, I was confused because the main character's name is Lucius. And, you know, I feel like Denzel Washington should have been named Lucius. You know, it would have made more sense.
He's having more fun, for sure. He's having a lot more fun than everybody else in the movie, who just looks a little stunned or dazed or angry or sad. And he is just running circles around everybody.
I would also say I like Joseph Quinn, who was the taller of the two emperors. He was the heavy. He's the heavy metal guy from Stranger Things, and he's going to be playing the Human Torch in the new Fantastic Four movie.
He's not the syphilitic one, right?
Is that what you're saying? I thought the syphilitic one was also pretty good, but I thought the taller one. I felt like he understood the movie he was in, and he gave it a go. But you know, I would say, you know, Denzel Washington just head and shoulders above the rest of the cast.
Yeah.
And you know, every line reading was just like, oh, that's a good one. Oh, nice.
But who's back? But Connie Nielsen is back. She's not given much to do. Derek Jacobi is back. He's just kind of like,
he really doesn't get much to do. I'm like, that's like Claudius. That's like Claudius in a toga. And they completely he was killed unceremoniously, kind of like Dustin Hoffman in Megalopolis, just like
the best death of the year, by the way. I love that.
Right.
Quick cut to him being crushed by, you know, like concrete.
That's kind of what happens in spoiler alert, in Gladiator 2. But all right, so, you know, this isn't, again, though, what's with all the animals?
What's with all the panning, the loving pans, digital, you know, recreations of the Colosseum with birds? Always birds, flocks of birds just fluttering by. Mm. Why? What's up with all these birds everywhere all the time?
Well, again, because I'm telling you, this is an animal movie at the end of the day.
Zootopia.
This is like, it's Zootopia, it's Madagascar, it's Gladiator 2. I mean, we can't, I can't, you know, that monkey was not CGI. That was a real monkey named Sherry.
With a real, like, little toga outfit that he, you know.
A little toga, a little diaper. It eats candy.
And appointed to the Senate, right? Isn't he appointed to the Senate, or doesn't he get some sort of
first consul?
He's first consul. He can order the Praetorian Guard around. It's pretty great.
And doesn't die. And I'm wondering, like, is the movie really about Lucius? you know, or is it about the monkey? Because to me, the monkey was the main character.
Your interest will always go to the most compelling aspect of any movie. So monkey.
Yeah. And I was just like, I was drawn to the monkey's journey.
I was drawn to Denzel shuffling. He's constantly shifting his toga. He uses his toga quite as a beautiful prop to, you know, kind of accentuate or punctuate anything he says. And he's just like, he's like moving his toga around his shoulders all the time, or he's like moving into a room with his toga head first. And I don't know. I loved seeing
him. He's always, every shot of him, even when he doesn't have dialogue, you can just see him scheming.
It's really great. I had a good time. And you know, there's good violence, good deaths in this too. I thought it was pretty good.
I thought there were some good fights, you know. And again, like a lot of the fights were with animals, and even big battles. There's like a big sea battle. There was a recreation of a sea battle. The Praetorian Guard like descends, like, you know, Gladiator was like a lot of gladiator fights, like one on one or
really
one
good
on
kills
ten.
Yeah, this is a little bit more group kills, right?
This is more like a kind of a, like a weird war movie. But I mean, both these movies play very fast and loose with Roman history, to say the least. But, you know, at least Gladiator had Marcus Aurelius. You know, this was like a Hanna-Barbera cartoon of Roman history almost.
Especially with all the animals.
Yeah, well, I expected Jabberjaw to like emerge from the from the Colosseum waters going, we're like, why wasn't there a talking dog while we're at it? But a lot of times when I go to the movies, I'm not looking for a deep and important experience. I'm just looking for some fun things that I grasp onto and I can make memes about. And Gladiator 2 has got this in droves.
Got the memes. But honestly, like, who asked for this movie? Who needed this movie? The first movie ends fine. You know, most of the important people are dead by the end of the first movie. There's no need for a sequel. This is absolutely unnecessary.
I guess so. Although the monkey's still alive at the end of the movie. Gladiator 3, Rise of the Diaper Monkey. It's coming.
I would watch it. I would actually honestly watch it because that's, you know.
Yeah.
Fall of Rome. Let's do it.
Who wouldn't? All right. Strength and honor, Stephen.
Okay.
You have to say it back.
Strength and honor. I'll see you at the Colosseum.
All right. Happy Thanksgiving, Stephen Garrett. Gladiator 2 is in theaters now. Bring your monkey. Make sure you put a diaper on it and enjoy the show. And also, go see Wicked. Why not? You've got 3 hours to kill. You like songs. You like witches. And you like Oz. And Wicked has all of those things. Also, thanks to Bobby Hilliard, Robert Dean, for talking to me about the Terrifier franchise. These are movies that I'm never going to see. But I feel like as an editor of a pop culture publication, I need to understand what's going on in pop culture, and Terrifier is definitely going on. I am Neil Pollack. I am going to go eat a large meal now. I hope you have had a wonderful weekend with your family and friends, and I will talk to you soon.
Original production. The Bookhouse is an independent bookstore with 2 locations in New Jersey, Millburn and Long Branch. Are you the guy who says they like to support indie bookstores? Good. Then be that guy. Come shop at The Bookhouse. Books, puzzles, games, coffee, cards, live author events, comedy nights, and most important, a real sense of community where actual human beings engage with one another. The Bookhouse in downtown Millburn and at Pier Village in Long Branch. That's The Bookhouse. Independent, local, quaint as fuck. Follow us on Instagram and come visit our stores.